welcome to the next of our interviews with the candidates for the June 17 election. And this morning I'm going to be speaking to Alan Dimmock, who's the candidate for UKIP. Alan, can you tell me about your background? I believe you were a county councillor for Yeovil.
Yes, go right back at the beginning. I was born in Poole, 1949. Left secondary modern school, no qualifications at the age of 15, but went straight into an apprenticeship. Spent 2 or 3 years working actually in the factory, and then the rest of my time was spent travelling in and around, extensively around Hampshire, Dorset, Somerset, Devon, and Wiltshire. For the last few years of my life, working life, I worked at a factory at Ilchester, Ilchester Cheese Factory as it was then. And when I was 62, I took early retirement, started up a little part-time job, a lot of time on my hand, and getting bored, nothing to do, and my wife said, well, find something to do, so then went into politics. Very, very late in the day, I was very privileged to be elected as a county councillor for Yeovil Central in 2013. Obviously the electorate changed their mind just recently, but I am a committed person at helping people and communities, and I have known that I have made a difference in people's lives.
Thank you. If you were elected, what three priorities would you see as the main things for action?
Funding is the biggest issue of all. It affects, obviously, the NHS, the care services, education, transportation, homes. So it's to get the economy back on its feet. When you consider that since 1973, when this country was taken into the European Economic Community, we have lost 4.2 million manufacturing jobs. The vast majority, if not all of them, have gone abroad. That leads to lack of career opportunities for all people. And it devastates local economies when you have one major employer in a small town or a village and they disappear. It's devastating for the local community.
Thank you. So that's the economy would be one, so two other.
Well, the economy, as I say, is important, yeah, to all. Education, mm-hmm, that must be one of the top three priorities. Mm. It's something that without education, people's lives are ruined. I do feel that the education system in this country, obviously there's a big thing at the moment regarding, I say, underfunding. When you look at the facts, there is more money being put into education today than there has ever been. But the young population, the population of young children, is absolutely grown beyond all manner of reason. There are another 420 school places will be required by 2020. It's going to cost millions and millions of pounds to build new schools. Existing schools will, if they have the room and haven't sold off their playing fields, we'll need to accommodate all these children. And it's one of these things that at the moment everyone is saying, oh, young children, get a good education, go on to university, which is a splendid thing, but it's being manipulated. The facts are that you get young children are told, get a good education, get a degree, you'll get a good job. That used to be the case, but it's been manipulated to get people into further education, higher education. A, it takes those people young people off the unemployment register. Many people, particularly from a poorer background, and the facts back this up, that in some universities, 18.9% of students pack up in the first year, that they haven't got that real academic background and feel, and they struggle. They get, some people obtain a degree. When they leave, they cannot get the job in the field that they have been studying for. So they take any job, but when they go to a job, the employer says, oh, what qualifications have you got? Oh, well, I've got this degree and this. And the employer says, well, you're too qualified for the job that we're offering. It's that thing that it's wrong. It needs a whole change of atmosphere. I'm a great believer, as I said, I'm a product of an apprenticeship. Yes, I feel that vocational training is the way forward. There are some people that are academically minded and they take to it like a duck from water. But it's not one size fits all.
Right, thank you very much. So we could include employment, I guess, in that as well. Now I have a question from Justin from Wellington, and he says, do you think your party should tone down the immigration rhetoric? Why not focus on other things that affect the working classes, like housing costs? What ideas do you have for slowing down the rapidly rising cost of privately rented property?
Concentrate not on immigration. Let's have a look at the facts. Now, in 2016, in Somerset, this is for the Department of Work and Pensions, there was a total of 3,913 national insurance numbers issued to Romanian nationals, Polish, Portuguese and Lithuanians. You talk about housing. They have all got to be housed. A lot of them will have children. They will go to the schools. We can build houses, but with the growth in the population, no matter how many houses you build, you just cannot keep up. And where are these people going to work? As I said, the manufacturing industry, which generates the wealth in this country, has been decimated. Some of that from EU, some of that from government policies. But education and housing, yes, a lot of it goes hand in hand. You have a good education, you get a good job, you can buy your own house. But the cost of housing has gone through the roof. Many people, millions of people on, if you like, low earnings, just cannot get onto that housing ladder. And the cost of renting, because of the demand placed on housing, is going through the roof. So at the end of the month, families have not got much money in their pocket. And the homelessness, they are people that, because of the change in working practices, it's like this zero-hour contract. How can a family budget when they don't know from one week to the next what money is coming into that their house? And if they go behind with a rent and they're evicted, then the cost falls back to the local authority. They've got to put them in bread and breakfast accommodation. It's that merry-go-round. I'll say merry-go-round, sad-go-round. People's lives are being devastated. And one of the main effects is through immigration. We talk about schools. 38% of all school entrants in Somerset over the last few years has been a direct result of inward immigration into this county. So it is an issue that affects everyone living and working in Somerset.
But do you think that cutting down on immigration would solve the housing problem?
Let's have a look at the Labour manifesto. page 24, it states that immigration has put a strain on all public services. You look at the Conservative Manifesto, page 54, it states that immigration has put the community bonding at risk. That is why they say they wanted to cut immigration down into the tens of thousands. Mm. But what do Labour propose to do? Oh, to reinstate the high impact fund. Everyone, the other parties know what the effect of immigration is having, but they don't publicise it. They will not confront the truth.
Right, I'll move on to a question from another listener, Johnny Doo. He says, in this election, the catchphrase strong and stable leadership has been much promoted, lauded and ridiculed in the debate so far. In your opinion, what actual hard evidence exists to convince the voter that your leader can make such a claim based on their past record?
A strong leadership. UKIP are one of those political parties which do not have a whip system. Other parties, they have a leader, and right, boys and girls, you will do what I say, you will do what you are told, whether they agree with that or not. And this is where so many bad decisions are made by senior politicians. They get an idea and they will not see the light at the end of the tunnel. So, yes, you do need a strong leadership, but it's working together for the common good. Keeping people, not to toe the line, that's the wrong word, but keeping them, shall we say, on the straight and narrow. Look, boys and girls, this is a road we're going down to. This is what we can achieve at the end of it. Now, keep together, march in time, and we will get there.
Right, thank you very much. Now then, a question from Barry. No one doubts that there are many people who are roofless or vulnerably housed, and that this is a scandal that must be addressed. All the major parties, and some of the relatively minor ones, seem committed to programmes of building houses in rural areas. These are supposed to include affordable housing, but it all depends on what you consider affordable. Wiveliscombe is a good example of the consequences. Since I first came here in 1992, the size of the town has increased by, at a rough estimate, 20%, but there are fewer jobs than there were 5 years ago, and Wivy seems on course to become a dormitory town for Taunton and places further afield. With inadequate public transport, this means more traffic. However, the schools and the GP surgery need to serve the increased population, but without extra resources, and this is already putting serious and potentially destructive pressure on these amenities. What would be your approach to addressing these issues?
That's a question of many facets onto it. You talk about employment opportunities lost in Wivy, and so people have got to travel to their place of work. I used to one time open up the factory at 5:30 in the morning to start up the machinery for the production line, and there are no public services, believe you me, 5 o'clock in the morning. It's something that the housing, you mentioned about the housing building in local towns and villages. Again, it's the increase in population, issues I've already mentioned before. But people who are born in the local community, in the local towns and villages, they can't afford to stay where they were born. They have got to drift in towards the larger urban areas, the larger towns, where house prices are generally lower. You used to have, in many towns and villages, and you will know them all, that you used to have the council housing. There always used to be maybe half a dozen or a dozen at the end of the village which was for local people. Our manifesto, we are committed to build factories which will produce the high insulated modular homes. Don't confuse that with the old prefab idea, though that served a purpose in its time in the 40s and 50s. It was a method of producing high quality houses at their time to house many, many people that were suffering the effects after World War II. We want to build these factories in various areas where there is a housing issue. We can deliver good quality first-time homes for first-time buyers. The prices we're working at is below £100,000, which should be affordable for all.
Hi, thank you very much. Now then, a question again from Barry about the mental health provision. And he asks, would you be willing to support the demands of Rethink Mental Health? Their demands are fair access to mental health services and support, an urgent review of funding for mental health services, and an improvement in the quality of care. A Mental Health Act fit for tomorrow, a legal system that treats people with severe mental illness with dignity and respect and facilities and facilitates recovery. Close the mental health employment gap, the right to support for people that are not well enough to work and those who are trying to get back to work, and a place to call home for everyone with severe mental illness. High quality, appropriate and affordable housing for people with severe mental illness.
Yes, we believe that there should be no differential between physical health and mental health. People are suffering, people are ill. All areas should be fully funded, and we'd go one step farther as well as putting money into finding out what causes some of the mental health issues. Again, it's all comes down to money and resources. When I was an elected county councillor, I helped fund various projects in sheltered housing schemes. Unfortunately, due to funding cuts imposed on the local authorities, the Health and Wellbeing Fund was ended. So all organisations in every field are suffering from cuts in money. And we keep on hearing this phrase, we are the fifth richest nation on earth. Well, someone please show me the money. All I can see is an IOU that we are £1.7 trillion in debt. I don't know rich people, but I imagine that rich people, one thing they have got is money in their pocket. They haven't got IOUs everywhere.
Mm. Okay, thank you. Now I have a question from Mary, and she says, my partner gets a state pension, but this does not stop his eligibility for attendance allowance. I also get a state pension, but this does stop my eligibility for carer's allowance. I'm his full-time carer, and I want to ask the candidates, why does no one want to take on this challenge of this anomaly?
We, in our manifesto, let's get this clear, regarding carers, we say they should get the same money as those people who are on job seekers allowance. And the care industry, without the carers, it would put extra strain on resources within the NHS. So yes, we feel that carers are ignored by the mainstream party. We must help these people. They do a marvellous job. And the provision of respite care as well, that is an area which is, again, sadly underfunded and is desperately needed. Some of these people who are committed caring for their loved ones or relatives or who work in the care industry, it is something that I don't think people realise the stress and strain which comes with caring for people 24 hours a day. And you need proper respite care facilities that your loved ones can go into safe, secure, well looked after environment, and you can take maybe a break, a short break, knowing that your loved ones are being fully looked after in the way that you want them to be looked after.
But that, or the increase in caring, the carer's allowance, wouldn't address the anomaly of not being able to claim it if you're on a state pension.
Yes, it's something when I claim the state pension, but both myself and my wife are in good health. Something we have talked about: what happens if one of us fall ill? The family, the children, have got their own lives to lead and bringing up the grandchildren. It is one of those things that a carer's allowance, if you've got your pension and it's there to live on, people do forget that the pension was brought in to supplement people's savings for their old age. And it's one thing that many people now, with the best will in the world, because of what's happened over the last 30 years, have been unable to save for their old age, because the cost of living and all the demands made on their on by society, that money isn't available to these people. They have no savings. I'm fortunate, I've got a very small amount of savings, but yes, it's something that, I agree, something that should be looked at to make sure that people are, bearing in mind they've possibly worked all their life, they've been part of the community, why should they suffer in their old age?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. I think we'll have one more question and then we'll have a break for some music. So, Dave has asked, do you regard climate change as a top priority for action? And what policies do you support to stop accumulating carbon emissions into the atmosphere?
Well, the EU, in their infinite wisdom, brought in the Climate Change Act, which, yes, I agree with in part. Air pollution. Now, one of the things to reduce CO2 emissions was to bring in diesel vehicles, and the EU in their wisdom spent billions of pounds to the car manufacturers to bring out efficient diesel engines, which reduce CO2 emissions by about 13% compared to a petrol engine. But 255 people died in Somerset in 2015 as a direct result of particulate and nitric oxide thing. We've got to look at scientific evidence. You will have a look at your weather forecast, particularly in the winter months, and they will show the map of the southwest, and they will have, in the towns it will be 3 or 4 degrees, in the rural areas expect a touch of frost. Towns attract heat. And funny enough, it's only a few days ago, some scientific research said that if 20% of the houses had their roofs painted white during the day, that would reflect heat back into outer space, and it would lower the temperature in the towns and cities by about 2 or 3 degrees. So global warming, yes, it is a point, but for every expert you can get to say this causes warming, you'll get another expert who will say, well, no, actually, that doesn't cause global warming. And when they have done research in the ice cap in Greenland, they have drilled through the ice cap, which goes back 100,000 years or more, and over millennium, temperature change has happened before the impact of man. I think it's more about air quality and caring for the environment. Don't destroy it, look after it, manage it properly. and bring back some of these rural industries, dry stone walling, the hedging, layering, you know, those skills have been lost. And a natural insulation is thatch roofs as well. But there are not many thatchers about, enough to go round. But again, we're losing those industries in the rural villages.
All right, let's have a break now for some more music. Was Okavana with Classical Gas. Just to break in our interview with Alan Dimmock from UKIP, who's the candidate for this next election. And I'd just like to, before the break, we were talking about climate change, and so I know from your manifesto that they want to repeal the Climate Act and to come out of the Paris Agreement, and I understand that your party would support fracking.
Yes, funny enough, it's been announced, I think yesterday, that in America there's another, the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant is being closed down for good and being decommissioned. And that is a direct result of fracking. There have been six nuclear power stations in America that have closed down in the last 2 years as a direct result of fracking, because the energy that is released through the fracking exercise has brought fuel costs down, and it has made the nuclear power stations inefficient. It has made them too expensive to maintain and run. So nuclear energy is one of the options that are being put forward, obviously, to address the energy shortages, and it's classed as renewable energy. But everyone knows that with a nuclear power station, it will generate electricity for maybe 30, maybe 40 years if you're lucky. And then it's got to be decommissioned. And it's the contamination which lasts for thousands of years. No one's quite sure how long it actually will last. That's the theory. I'm a strong believer in renewable energy, but one of the issues I think that is being missed by the main parties is run-of-the-river power generation. Our country for 2,000 years have been, if you like, a powerhouse, and in particularly during the Industrial Revolution. And where did that power initially come from? It came from the flow of waters running down the river. You don't have to build big dams everywhere. You convert a lot of the old underused mills that sit in a picturesque area in our countryside, and you can have small, medium-scale power generation, particularly for the local communities, and that is not dependent on whether the sun shines or whether the wind blows. It doesn't depend on the tide coming in or coming out. It is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks of the year. And they reckon, I think Beeson Mill is a good example. It generates quite a lot of power. You haven't built dams anywhere. You've not flooded the countryside. You haven't destroyed farmland. It works. I think more money and research should go into that method. Obviously, yes, in other countries, they're fortunate enough to have big rivers, high waterfalls. You have hydropower. But I think run of the river in areas is a must, and we must put more money and research into that method.
Thank you. Another question from Justin from Wellington. If you were voted in on June the 8th and were asked to back invading the Middle East or airstrikes in the Middle East at some point in the future, would you?
Generally speaking, no. We've been involved in foreign wars, or dragged into them illegally, some people might argue. But when you impose your will on some other country, it's wrong. There are incidents when, yes, you cannot stand by and let evil happen, but it must be based on sound judgment, and if it's the will of the majority of the people in that country that they feel they need assistance. Look at Bosnia as an example. If you like, the international community came together. Rwanda in Africa, you had massacres from one ethnic minority on another ethnic minority. There are some times when the world community acting together has got to make a stand against evil, but it's got to be based on sound judgment.
Thank you. Now, this is an anonymous question. What do you think about UKIP not standing candidates in three Somerset constituencies, Somerset and Frome, Wells and Yeovil, to help the Conservative candidates? And are you concerned that by standing in Taunton Deane, you may stop Rebecca Powell from being elected?
I stood in the Somerton and Frome constituency 2 years ago against David Warburton. David Warburton and Marcus Fish in South Somerset, they are committed Brexiteers. Rebecca Powell actively campaigned to remain in the EU. She said she's now changed her mind. There's another woman in another party that changed her hairdo and changed her mind. I'm not convinced. Why are we not putting up a candidate against the candidates you mentioned? It's because UKIP are committed to get us out of the EU on the best possible terms that can be obtained. But bearing in mind we are one country talking to the EU, but they're made up of 27 other countries, and each one of them has got to agree. So it's not going to be easy, but we feel that if we were to stand against a committed, if you like, Brexiteer MP, and there are many in other parties as well, not just the Conservatives, there are Labour MPs as well that are committed to get us out of the EU, we feel that it would weaken the process. So that's why we, the party, have said no, we will not stand against committed Brexiteer MPs.
Right. Now, your manifesto talks about building grammar schools in every town.
It doesn't say that at all.
No.
How many people realise that the academy schools, when they were sent up by Labour in 2006, the Education Act, they all have the right, if they choose to do so, to select 10% of their pupil intake on ability? It's the same as a grammar school. I tell you one thing, it's not what politicians tell you, it's what they don't tell you. There's a lot of things hidden away that someone could pick up a phone call tomorrow and say, right, no, we want the academies. And bearing in mind, academies are private companies. It's privatisation of our education system. They have the right, as I said, to select 10% of the input of pupils of their choosing. You say grammar schools, yes, it gives an opportunity for people that are academically minded, because one size doesn't fit all. Some people can sit down and study great, other people they just can't do it. I'll be one of those people. I worked all my life with my hands, say, in engineering and electrical. One size doesn't fit all, but it's giving people the choice. Just because a grammar school has been set up, if there is a demand for it, that's the criteria. So it's not going to be imposed, and people will have the right. You don't have to sit the entrance exam if the pupil and the parents don't wish to do so. There's nothing compulsory about it. It's that freedom of choice.
Thank you. This question's about the structure of government. I see from your manifesto that you would favour abolishing the House of Lords and creating an English Parliament. How would that work?
Yes, well, when you get the House of Lords as it stands at the moment, someone has done someone a favour. Oh, here we are, you can become Lord so-and-so of the manor. Oh, by the way, if you go up there and sign the register in the morning and then go into the subsidised canteen and have a cup of coffee and go home without doing anything, you can earn £300 a day. That's obscene. The second chamber, it shouldn't be there by right. It should be elected, like they have, say, maybe in the American system or other governments in the world. The English Parliament, we have a Scottish Parliament. You have the Welsh Assembly. Now we even have the regional assembly, like the London Assembly. So why not an English Parliament for England? Northern Ireland, that they do the same as well. So it's again, it's that devolution, putting power down to local areas that people have more control over. Well, hopefully they have more control over. No, the whole system wants looking at. I believe that obviously the Electoral Commission are looking at and the Boundary Commission are looking at changes. I believe the proposal is at the next general election, after this one, there will be 50 fewer MPs. Again, that's a cost-cutting exercise. Why shouldn't they feel the pinch, same as the rest of us?
So that would, to get back to this idea of an English parliament, is the idea that how would that work with the assemblies in Scotland and Wales?
At the moment, you have got the Scottish Parliament, you got the Welsh Assembly. They, if you like, England, Britain devolves power down to the Welsh Assembly and to the Scottish Parliament. What we're saying, you should have an English Parliament that's only open to English MPs. They can decide laws in England. Because at the moment, even though we're one country, i.e. Great Britain, you have got Scottish law and you have got English law. It works for them, it works for us. Why should one organisation impose their laws and what have you on another area? And then you could have the English Parliament could work maybe 2-3 days a week, and then all the areas, the Welsh Assembly members, the Scottish Parliament and the English Parliament come together to discuss national laws and make national laws. Again, that would only work once we are out of the EU, because at the moment, when a directive is issued from the EU, that by statute goes on to our law book and takes precedence over any existing law.
Thank you. About agriculture, what would your policies be to help farmers as we come out of Europe?
In our manifesto we want to state we indicate the pillar one support. There's a lot of feeling, a lot of information that is said, or what about funding for the farmers? They are critical, always have been. At the moment, we pay in £24 billion to the EU, and the farm, the Common Agricultural Policy payments all come out from that money that we pay into the EU anyway. It isn't EU money, it's just money returned to here. But there's a £9 billion shortfall from what we pay into the EU and what comes back, A, to the farmers, to the universities and other regional grants. So money for the farmers will be absolutely guaranteed for eternity, if you like, not just for the next 5 years. Farming is a long-term industry. It takes years to build up pedigree herds and what have you. You can't budget on a 3-5 year plan. No, that money will be remain, and our farmers will be fully supported. Obviously, extra payments will be used for hilltop farmers and whatever, because obviously not all farmers have an ideal level playing field, shall we say. Some are on very different soils, uplands, lowlands, all sorts. All they will all be looked after, and the money will be there. And again, it's at no extra cost to the ratepayers and taxpayers.
So why would that be, that there wouldn't be an extra cost?
We already pay our taxes, and we send, as I said, £23 billion a year to the EU. We get a rebate, we get money returned via the Common Agricultural Policy, we get money sent to our universities, and we get regional aid grants. But we're still contribution giving to the EU over £9 billion a year. That £9 billion a year can be kept in this country and used to support our NHS, education and other vital services. UKIP are under the belief, and I passionately believe, that there is enough money in the system already. What money is in the system is ill-advisedly spent. When you consider the millions being spent on this HS2 rail link between London and Birmingham. Oh, they save half an hour. So if you want to get out there at 5, catch the earlier train. That money, again, should be spent nationwide improving our local rail networks. Again, obviously, the other big lot of money we're spending is in foreign aid. We're committed to foreign aid, don't get me wrong, but not the quantity that is being spent. And when you consider that some of that money is going to North Korea. Now, can anyone justify to me why foreign aid money that our taxpayers are paying goes to North Korea? I would be very interested in a response to that. Our proposals regarding, again, foreign aid, I'll just touch on it, is to build a fully equipped, fully manned hospital ship to send anywhere in the world at instant notice should there be a humanitarian or a natural crisis. It can travel freely throughout the world, administering help and assistance when and where needed.
I think we'll come to our last question now. Could you explain the point system of immigration that you're looking to introduce?
it's a very good question. Immigration. We know that it does bring benefits. It's about the quality and the quantity. Obviously, Labour had the open door policy where everyone could come in regardless of what they brought with them, what skills. And a lot of people say, oh, we need the skills. Sorry, we used to have the skills. Again, what's gone wrong with our education system if we cannot train our own people in the skills which we need? Something has failed, again, say, in the education system. And bearing in mind, a lot of people who have been born, lived in this country, have gone abroad to further their careers. Again, it's because of the lack of career opportunity, lack of jobs. So we would look at the job market and you think, what do we need? What skills are needed for the betterment of our community? Yes, we need to build more houses. So we would have bricklayers, carpenters, electricians, plumbers, tilers. If we wanted to build rebuild our shipbuilding industry, for argument's sake. Yes, we have got a small dedicated workforce now, but generally those skills have been neglected, that we're not bringing on new people in that industry. So if we were to start rebuilding our industries which we have lost and we haven't got the skills and knowledge, then we would look at the people that have got the skills and the knowledge and can pass that down to us, and we would allow them into this country. As I say, it would be based on need. Do we need the skills that person or persons have, and are they a benefit to the people in this country? Yes. So that is how the system would work.
And there would be a visa for seasonal workers that might be needed in agriculture.
Yes, we would go reinstate what's happened before we joined the EU, the seasonal agriculture workers visa scheme. It would be controlled, monitored. But yes, so again, there's a lot of fear being or misinformation. I will state now, Brexit, whatever it takes, has no fears for me, and I'm doing it for my not for my children. They're grown up, they're big enough boys and girls now, but my grandchildren, I'm doing it for them. I want them to have the best possible future that they can possibly have.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. And so that concludes our interview for today on from the UKIP candidate. And but don't forget that you can listen to the interviews with Rebecca Powell and Gideon Amos that have already been done on 10 Radio when they're repeated, and there will also be podcasts available. And tomorrow there will be an interview from I think it's Martin Jevon tomorrow, and on Friday the Green Party candidate is that Clive Martin. So they're at 9 o'clock after the breakfast shows, but do look at the 10 Radio schedule to find out when the repeats are happening.